Welcome to McKinsey Talks Talent, featuring McKinsey leaders and talent experts, Brian Hancock and Brooke Weddle. I'm Lucia Raheli.
A lot of times, if you talk to a frontline employee, what they're seeing is right in front of them. And they can say, here's five ideas for how this could go better. There should be a process for gathering this feedback, and it should be directed in the right ways in keeping with the top-down innovation strategy.
That's Brooke. She's talking about the overlooked role of frontline employees in driving innovation. It's just one practice explored in the new release of McKinsey's Organizational Health Index. Brooke joins Brian and me as we discuss why these practices are so vital in helping you outperform the competition. Brooke, Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be back.
Great to see you.
So we're talking today about research on organizational health. And while the research is new, the construct of organizational health is most decidedly not. Brooke, tell us, does organizational health still matter?
Yes, it still matters. And yes, it still maintains its ability to predict long-term performance. The OHI and the organizational health body of research is over 20 years old. And we continue to live in a very dynamic environment. Lots of focus these days on building resilience, on thinking about productivity and doing that in keeping with new employee preferences about how they want to do work and how they want to interact with their employers. And the research was very clear that empirical relationship held up. And not only is organizational health correlated with long-term performance, it is causal. It drives long-term performance.
What are some areas where better organizational health makes a measurable difference in organizational performance, a causal difference, as Brooke just said?
What we see is there are a set of what we call power practices that across any organization, they need to get right from an organizational health standpoint to drive performance. Those are things like strategic clarity. Are our goals clear and measurable? Are they articulated at all levels? Things like role clarity. Do people understand day to day what they're supposed to be doing? Competitive insights. Do we understand how we fit in versus our competitors? Do people feel ownership over their work? If people are excelling on those power practices, it makes sense that the performance follows.
I work with a lot of business leaders and they say, look, I'm doing what I think are the right things. I'm measuring engagement. I'm looking at employee satisfaction. And yet I don't see the behaviors in terms of how we are running this place that I want to see that I think would help drive performance. And those could be having leaders have courageous conversations, taking risks, innovating more at pace. And I think the insight there is what organizational health is all about is aligning on this strategy, translating it into the work environment, and renewing the organization over time. And it's an organization level metric. It is not an individual level metric. When you assess organizational health, you do not ask about things like, do you have a great relationship with your manager? It's not to say it's not important. Of course, that's important, but that is not what organizational health is about. You start to look at a measure that allows you to say, I have engaged and satisfied employees, and I'm pointing those employees in the right directions to support execution, to renew the organization over time.
We hear again and again that leaders are navigating what might be the toughest ever operating environment given serial disruptions like Gen AI and rising geopolitical risk, persistent economic uncertainty, and so forth. In this context, what matters most to organizational health?
I'd start with the four power practices that Brian names: strategic clarity, role clarity, personal ownership, and competitive insights. These four things are must-have. In fact, I say must-have, but there's real statistical evidence behind this. If those four practices are in the bottom quartile of our database as measured against the benchmark, your chances of organizational health, high organizational health, are essentially zero. And so you must have those four things in place. Now, the second order question is, okay, got it. I have those four things. How do I start to think about designing a bespoke recipe that is going to allow me to create the conditions that I need to run this business? And there's no one answer to that question because we live in a world with a lot of different business models and a lot of different leadership preferences in terms of how they want to run organizations. And so that's where you get into more tailoring around the specific practices, behaviors, and mindsets that you would want to see that would enable your own performance outcomes.
At the same time, we've added a new survey section on employee experience that is looking at things like well-being, including burnout and psychological safety, looking at things like connection to meaning, which we know post-pandemic is more important than ever, things on career growth and talent attraction and retention. Some of those factors are ones that we know, in particular in this current environment, are important. And we've also added more specific questions around inclusion and making sure that we're creating an environment where everyone feels like they are included and belong.
What about leadership? You talk in the research about what it means to be a decisive leader versus a dictatorial one. What is that difference? Is it about, you know, velocity of decision making in the current
environment? I don't know. It's kind of up in the air. Like, what does that really mean, decisive leadership? I mean, you could have like four different perspectives on it. And I mean, Brooke, what do you think?
I was wondering where you were going with that one.
I mean, decisive leader just talks and get on with it, right? I mean, a decisive leader can take input and make a decision.
The exact definition that we're using for decisive leadership, which is very in keeping with how you described it, is making and following through on decisions in a timely manner. Now, decisive leadership replaces another leadership practice we used to have on the OHI, and that's because decisive leadership turns out to be a better predictor of overall leadership as an outcome versus this other one, which was called authoritative leadership. And authoritative leadership didn't make the cut this time around. And authoritative leadership, just to give you the definition, was applying pressure to drive results, right? And we're seeing that that is actually not a good way to lead these days.
How does data inform decisiveness enterprise-wide, in other words, both on the part of leaders and their employees?
So the way our colleagues often describe this is fast but good decision-making, and data helps fast and good decision-making in two ways. There's research from Stanford that have been looking at uses of generative AI in organizations, and one of the things they've done is looked at how teams converge after a decision has gotten made. And they can look at Slack and look at the different Slack streams for a given team and see if the team is, after the decision, really converging and moving on that decision, or whether there is still divergence happening in the team. So the data can be also helpful for a decisive leader afterwards to make sure that they understand where there is still rumblings of dissent in the organization and revisiting to make sure, hey, we are really following through and addressing any of those root cause challenges that some of the individual leaders may be hypothesizing are happening within their team.
Can data also empower employees to innovate in addition to what you just described, making better, faster, more frictionless decisions?
Yes. When you're talking about data at the fingertips of employees at all levels, including frontline employees, can be very powerful in terms of driving innovation. And one of the things that has always been a well-performing practice, if you will, when you look at the OHI and the survey, is this practice called employee innovation. It used to be called bottom-up innovation because it is all about harnessing the best ideas from all levels, including the front line, to drive innovation and continuous improvement. And a lot of times, if you talk to a frontline employee, what they're seeing is right in front of them and can say, here's five ideas for how this could go better. And organizations that listen to that and do it in a structured way, right? There should be a process for gathering this feedback, and it should be, you know, kind of directed in the right ways and keeping with the top-down innovation strategy, can be very effective at driving that continuous improvement.
But data-driven decision-making needs to go along with some other parts of the organizational health framework for it to be successful. I mean, someone famous once said, if you torture data long enough, it'll tell you whatever you want it to say, right? And so what you need as a pair to that data-driven decision-making is also an open and trusting work environment where people feel the safety to be able to raise questions that they have.
There's a great example of data-driven innovation in the research related to Major League Baseball. I have to say it resonated in part because I've benefited from it personally as my kids have gotten more interested in going to baseball games. Talk us through that example.
Well, Major League Baseball used data analytics to drive some pretty significant changes in terms of how they run teams, the team operations, how managers think about recruiting the best talent. Lucia, you might be referring to one of the data-driven innovations that we need to change the way that pitching works so that we don't have as long of games. And I've benefited from that as well. So I think it is all about, you know, it's a little bit of the money ball approach here, but using those analytics to really inform innovations that actually make the user or the end user experience that much more enjoyable and of course to drive more productive outcomes as well.
But you needed to have a view of both the end user experience as well as the data in the game as it was currently played, because some of the data made baseball more boring. I mean, the way that you could position infielders for different power hitters so that you would have these extreme versions of a shift would have some of the best hitting players have a choice of hitting into what is more likely than not an out in the direction they're going, or take a relatively boring bunt or hit the other way to get a single. Baseball took a step back and said, well, from a user experience standpoint, that does not create a more exciting game with more followers that builds the game. Data needs to be looked at holistically, not just in the narrow context of how do I get this batter out, but data more broadly of why is this an exciting game and how do you use data holistically to get to the broad end goal, not just the narrow one?
There's a great data point in the research showing that employees who experience more mobility at work are considerably less likely to burn out. I think the figure was 27%. What stands in the way of enabling more mobility in organizations?
I think a few things stand in the way of mobility. One is, how do we think beyond the typical career progressions that someone might experience? And so if you're in a siloed organization where the only next job you're going to get is your boss's job, it makes mobility harder. It makes it harder for you to move up in an organization. If you're able to have an organization that recognizes that your underlying skills, your capabilities, your potential could be well suited in that silo or in other parts of the organization, you get the benefit of being able to move to a different environment where you're learning, where you're, you know, able to grow, where you're able to move. Brooke, what's your take?
Yeah, I agree. Getting access to development and mobility over time are key drivers of what helps employees to stay at an organization. I would also say that burnout was one of these new features that is now, it's a core, you know, set of practices that we ask about now when we are assessing organizational health. And it's turned out to be a very important moderator, meaning if you are burnt out, you have very low probability of perceiving anything about your organization as remotely healthy.
Brooke, do you have an example from your client work or from the research of an organization that is addressing and mitigating burnout productively?
I've worked with a couple of organizations that have taken that on as a key priority in the broader frame of how do we address wellness, how do we get employees to thriving, and how do we do that in a way that helps our business achieve its outcomes. I think people tend to think a lot of thoughts about burnout, but what does that actually mean, right? Burnout, if you look at it, has to do with figuring out kind of how roles are defined. There are certain parts of roles that might be rethought and even using things like Gen AI to push some of the transactional work off that does not help to motivate employees. Another key factor that involved the manager was really spending time connecting one's work to the larger purpose of the organization. And then the last thing I'd say is it's a journey. And I think this organization in particular understood that capability building would be a large part of that journey over time, because as they helped managers figure out their role in addressing burnout, there was a lot of capability building and kind of awareness they had to generate on that front.
Any other changes to this revamp of the Organizational Health Index that you want to highlight that are reflective of the current complexity of the world of work?
So we had two new survey modules. One of the modules was on employee experience, as we talked about before, and the other was on workplace flexibility in terms of where are people working today, what are their preferences, what's the primary means of communication, what's the schedule or location flexibility, what's the workspace design. There's a recent article that highlighted the practices of Land O'Lakes. And what they're doing is they have an acute shortage of people that are working in their manufacturing facilities. And they used to have two set 12-hour shifts, kind of a day shift and a night shift, because that was the way to maximally drive production. Unfortunately, there weren't enough workers to actually fit those shifts. So they shifted to a world, no pun intended, of being able to have employees pick which hours they wanted to work. It put a little more burden on the system, a little more burden on the managers, but when they provided that flexibility, they were actually able to get more total working hours done.
The other things that I would highlight that have been introduced in this revised version of organizational health is there were a couple of other additional management practices that were added in. One is social responsibility as it relates to a larger category of external orientation. I think acknowledging that this is a core part of how organizations add value. And by the way, employees are putting a lot of importance on that in terms of the attractiveness of an organization. Feedback, the practice of feedback was added to the broader category of accountability, recognizing that as you think about performance management and the manager and managee relationship, that feedback loop cannot be taken for granted and must be a core practice to get accountability right. And then the last one I would mention is in direction. Common purpose was added side by side with strategic clarity and shared vision, recognizing again the importance that many companies are placing on really having a clear articulation of their purpose in the world. And again, how that connects back to employee value proposition and employees kind of seeing their employers as a place where they can derive individual purpose as well.
These features, these sort of intrinsics of organizational health have changed. Does the bar for what health means also move over time? In other words, are companies generally healthier now than they were, say, a decade ago?
There's still a broad range of organizational health outcomes across organizations. And while some of the poorest health organizations may have ceased to become organizations, there are others that are also of poor organizational health that are coming in to replace them at the bottom. So the bar may be moving, the average may be moving, but we still have a pretty broad distribution of performance. And we still see across that distribution of performance, those that are healthier are better performing.
Do you see leaders really investing in organizational health now as a priority?
Absolutely. I'm working with a number of organizations that are making this a priority. One organization that I'm working with now started with a very low organizational health index score. And it has been a good news story because the leaders of that organization use that as a rallying cry to say, we can do something different here, right? And we can do something different that really matters. And so they've really embarked on a pretty significant transformation that is just as much about driving better execution and performance as it is about building their culture and investing in their ranks up and down the organization.
I'm also seeing an uptick in organizations to say, what is my baseline of the managerial practices that drive organizational health? And how can I help my managers get better at those practices which actually drive our performance day to day? And so when organizations align on their organizational health recipe, then they come in to say, okay, we know we need to do this through our managers. How do we help our managers provide more role clarity for people on their teams? How do we help managers link what we're asking the teams to do to the broader purpose? So we often see this coming through just as strongly in a question of, hey, how do I help my managers be better leaders? Because that is one of the levers by improving those management practices in a thoughtful way to improve overall organizational health.
Quick follow on sort of the efficacy of OHI as a tool. It's so much easier to survey employees now than it was when we first introduced the Organizational Health Index. There's polls, there's the range of digital means. Is survey fatigue inevitable? And if no, how should leaders avoid it?
I think survey fatigue is always going to be hard. We've seen more bite-sized versions of kind of pulsing, right, to make it not only feel more digestible, but also more real-time, right? There are, of course, passive ways to collect data as well. For instance, creating social network maps based on email traffic flows, calendar invites, that can give you a pretty good sense, too, of some of the features of organizational health. So you really got to take more of a strategic view of listening these days and not rely as much on these traditional kind of heavy efforts to really survey employees.
I mean, the analogy I use is that OHI is like an MRI. What we're doing is we're looking at all the systems. And yes, that does take time. But it does create the ability to identify where there may be specific opportunities having taken that holistic view. Once we have the view of the MRI and we know, hey, let's look at the heart or the circulatory system in this area or whatever sub element come up in the MRI, then you don't need to do an MRI again in the next month to track how you're doing. You can actually just track the heart.
Suppose I'm a leader and I'm looking to energize my organizational health efforts. Talk me through what next steps look like.
Part of the beauty of bringing math and science to a discussion on organizational health is you have math and science, right? And so you got to start with measuring your starting point and also creating a common language around what you're trying to create, not just from a current state perspective, but where you want to head. And then it's all about taking action, right? And that will include things like leader role modeling. It will certainly involve some kind of change story and an integrated communications plan. Sometimes the reason a leader doesn't embrace a new behavior is because they have no idea how to. And so capability building is a big component. And then finally, the alignment of incentives, right? Think through the talent system and how people are rewarded, not just financially, but even in the non-financial recognition. If that is not in keeping with the behaviors you want to emphasize, guess what? People won't embrace them. So there's a real holistic and rigorous methodology behind not just the diagnostic part of this, but the taking action part.
You also need to have a CEO and a senior leadership team that wants to take a hard and honest look at how we run the place. If senior leaders aren't ready to take a hard look at the place, it doesn't make sense to ask employees these sets of questions that then surfaces areas and questions that they will have as to, well, how are we going to make progress on these areas and what are we going to do? So I think it does take that real leadership commitment to take a look at how we run the place and a real leadership belief in the data that shows, and if we run the place better, we get better outcomes. If you've got that alignment in the top, combined with all of the things Brooke just said, I think that's a real recipe for success here.
Brooke and Brian, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Lucia. So fun.
Great to be with you.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Lucia Rahilly with Brian Hancock and Brooke Whittle. Follow McKinsey Talks Talent wherever you get your podcasts.